Welcome to the We Are JV podcast, where we connect through conversations of community, humanness, and well-being in Chaffee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today, I'm talking with Laura Richardson. Laura is a local rancher who, in recent years, graduated from the Master of Fine Arts program at Western Colorado University, where she pursued her interest in nature writing. As a result, she published The Table, a memoir that dives into her and her family's life on the ranch, growing hay and raising cattle, and connecting deeply as a family. That life they share is fascinating to me. The family connections feel extraordinary to me. I'm curious about it all, and in some ways, probably even envious of some things about it. It's just so rooted in American traditions, and, I mean, human history, for that matter. There was a time in the 1800s when 90% of Americans were farmers. Today, only around 1% are. So this conversation that I got to have with Laura, and especially with getting to read her memoir as well, it's enlightening to me. And by the numbers, the odds are good that it will be for you too. Laura has described her childhood as one of a suburban latchkey kid of the 80s and with divorced parents. But later she would marry into a family with deep ranching roots and would become best friends with her in-laws. Her story weaves through the generations and the strong family bonds that include her and her husband Andrew's 5 kids, along with their cousins, uncles, aunts, and grandparents, and it extends to the neighbors and the surrounding ranching community, even as this way of life that has already fallen to only 1% of us continues to face existential challenges. We talk about the value of agricultural land, monetarily and otherwise, and the increasing pressures of land development. We talk about the daily risks and rewards of working on the ranch, and how constant learning and innovations are critical for ranchers to survive and thrive. We also talk about the vulnerability of writing such a memoir and putting it out in a small rural community, where it's common to say things like, "We all know each other." But publishing a memoir really is letting people in to know who you are, what you think, and what you have to share. Though, like Laura says, it's a gift to be able to share a story, and it's a gift to be able to listen to someone's story. The We Are Chaffee podcast is supported by Chaffee County Public Health. Go to wearechaffeepod.com for all things related to this podcast, including links, transcript, and photos related to this episode, and all the others in the archive. All right, on we go with the gift of Laura Richardson's story. Your memoir was so enlightening. It was eye-opening for me. I grew up in a rural town. I grew up surrounded by farm kids, and they went hunting, and they raised cattle, and grew crops, and all these things, but that wasn't my life. I was a town kid. Yeah. So I felt like I could come into your book and have some idea what I might read. And yet it was just still so eye-opening because there were details and stories and the imagery and everything that just took me to places that I had no idea. So I think this was educational.
Oh, good.
I want to know, I guess then, how you came to be comfortable with some of these things, because I don't think you grew up with ranching, right? You married into it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, my first experience really with ranching was a senior in high school. I did a program called Senior Field Studies from Bear Creek High School in Lakewood, and we had to go spend 2 weeks on a farm. And so I was down in Rocky Ford for 2 weeks on a cattle ranch, and I didn't know the difference between a heifer and a cow and a bull and a steer and just anything, and we had to do everything. And so, yeah, that was my first experience. And then when I met Andrew, his family, his grandparents ranched, and so we spent some time on their ranch. And but he was a landscape architect student when we met. So,
but he grew up with it. It sounds like.
No, well, with his grandparents, he did. Yes, for sure. But his dad was an engineer, so he lived just in the foothills outside of Denver his whole childhood.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So both of you grew up with childhoods that are very different than that of your children.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Was that difficult to step into that world and start learning so many things that you needed to know. And for Andrew as well, although he obviously had that exposure through grandparents.
Yeah.
I just feel like it's so amazing how much work goes into all of this and how much knowledge you have and all the things you're dealing with.
Absolutely. Every year we learn something. You'd think after, what, this will be our 26th year that we've got it all down, and absolutely not. Every year we learn something different. So we're always learning.
Was it difficult for you to become accustomed to things like, it, for example, there's an anecdote, a story that you describe in branding and castration day and what your role is in that even is, I mean, but actually any of those roles, I think I would find it hard for me to do. You know, your kids would have to lead me through how does all this work.
Yeah.
But you're out there castrating these male calves, right?
Yeah.
Like, how did you ever get used to that?
I think it just has to be done at the moment, and there's a timeline, and you have like 30 seconds to get in there, and so you don't really think about it. You just dive in, and it's like you want to make sure you get it done correctly, because if not, you have a bull instead of a steer running around in your herd, and so you only want specific bulls, and it's all just important work, but it happens really quickly, and you want to do it right. And but it's fascinating too. I'll never forget the first chicken that. We were slaughtering chickens one day, which we don't do on a regular basis, but our neighbor has this cool contraption where you can, well, you kill the chicken first and then you hold it by its feet and you put it on this machine with these like rubber fingers and it goes in a circle and it defeathers them. And then you open the chicken and you take all of its guts out. But inside the chicken was all these stages of an egg. So it was like today's egg. And then the next day's egg, and it was just the stages of the moon, kind of, but
wow.
inside a chicken. And so they're hard shells, and then down to like where they start getting soft, and then they're tiny. And it was just, so to me, it's all just fascinating how it works. Yeah, I love it.
It sounds like, well, did you have an interest in science at all before that? Or is that, because that's something that I think is fascinating. It could really make me think, like, I need to dive into this. This is wild. I had no idea these things were going on.
I don't think I've had much of a mind for science, but I do, and I mean, you've seen this in the book, but like my faith resides pretty strongly in science, like in the natural world and creation and how things work, and I'm fascinated daily by things I learn or things I see or hear, and it never gets old because you can't ever stop learning something new. It's exciting.
I'm going to call out one other story that especially It was kind of stunning to me as a non-agricultural, non-ranching person. And that was where you graft a calf that has lost his mother cow.
Yeah.
You know, or the and with a mother cow that has lost her calf.
Mm-hmm.
And what was involved in this, as you describe, which could feel graphic to somebody who's really not used to this kind of thing happening,
mm-hmm.
is where Andrew essentially takes the skin off of the calf that unfortunately died, but then it's put to good use by tying this over a live calf in hopes that the mother, who was not his natural mother, would take to him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what my question is on that, other than, again, I'm really trying to get into your seat and understand when you were first learning that these things existed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And what that was like, maybe to learn, you know, do what?
Yeah,
I mean, you're, this is gonna work. How?
Yeah, yeah. That's it. That does feel like it's a shocking thing to see, you know. Except for the fact that my husband and my sons have all hunted. Actually, my daughter too have all been hunting ever since we've been married. And so to see maybe, you know, your first elk being processed and the hide, you know, coming off. And so it wasn't a foreign thing to me, at least early on in our marriage. You know, the first time I ever, you know, helped process an elk, it's kind of like, oh. But then again, it's fascinating to me and just amazing to see the, you know, muscles encased in this amazing fascia. And just, it's fascinating. It's science. And I love that for sure.
You point out in the book, if I remember correctly, I think that back in the 1800s at some point, around 90% of Americans lived on farms.
Yes. Yes.
And today, it's only around 1%.
Yes. Yes.
So I think even though I feel like I'm sort of stumbling through with naivete and ignorance in this experience of learning and having to acknowledge, even though I grew up in a rural area, mm-hmm. all of this is foreign to me, mm. right? I go to a grocery store and or a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I'm completely separated from these processes. And so I think that that is probably the case for then, let's say, 99% of the people who are listening.
Yes. And for me, too. I mean, I go to the grocery store still. I think about that a lot. You know, I don't milk our cows for milk. You know, I buy milk. I buy a lot of groceries. You know, we raise a lot of food, you know, beef, obviously, and then a garden in the summer and stuff. But I'm right there with you. We're pretty disconnected from a lot of our food sources where, like you were talking about, long ago, people used to raise all of their food, really. You know, they would go maybe to like a general store for some things like white sugar and, you know, go to a miller for flour, you know, I'd have it milled and stuff like that. But in general, there wasn't a thing of going somewhere for your food. It was a foreign concept.
I think about those early ranchers who started out here and there wouldn't have been, you know, the towns that mm-hmm. we have now, there wouldn't have been the ease of those stores. Mm-hmm. And they would have come out and been trying to, I think, learn how to do this at high elevation.
Yeah.
What do, you know, livestock need in order to thrive and prosper here and for a business to? Mm-hmm. You also grow hay.
Yes.
I think I read, as I'm about to say this number, it sounds so big to me.
Yeah.
I feel like I must be wrong, but I'm thinking you said 30,000 bales?
Yes. Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't even picture. I don't know how to picture that. That's such a wild amount to me.
Yeah.
And those are 60-pound bales.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So that's kind of the, I picture or maybe three sizes of bales. Like, are there small rectangles, then maybe these 60-pound rectangles, and then the large round bales that people would all recognize as they're driving somewhere?
Yes. So we do put up large round bales now. We used to feed, when we had less cattle, we would feed small bales off the back of a pickup. But it becomes pretty labor intensive when you're feeding hundreds of cows every day. And so we do have round bales now, and those weigh about 1,500 pounds. And so we have a feeder that we pull behind a tractor and it just unrolls it like a roll of toilet paper of hay the field. Yeah,
I think I've actually seen that once just in driving by somewhere years ago.
Yeah.
That was kind of cool to see because, again, even those simple things that are so basic to those who are doing the work, mm-hmm. for those of us who are so separated from it, it's just eye-opening. So I want to talk about when you and Andrew decided that you were going to start this life in this, I mean, I hesitate to use the word career, right? It's much bigger and deeper and richer than just a job that's a career. Mm. But you came into this along with his side of the family.
Yes.
And there's so much to all of this, as you write about in the book, the intergenerational, multiple generations mm-hmm. involved extended family. Mm-hmm. You know, that could be aunts, uncles, cousins.
Yes.
There's so much that you're involved in that is family oriented mm-hmm. for work, play, church, mm-hmm. and so much love. Mm. And I, you know, it's almost sad to admit, but I feel like that also feels foreign to me to have that sort of interdependence and the mentorship that it mm-hmm. sounds like you got from your mother-in-law and your father-in-law mm-hmm. and the closeness of everybody.
Yeah, for sure. It takes a lot of people to run a ranch. And, you know, when our kids were little, they weren't super helpful, you know. And so, therefore, I wasn't very helpful. And so my sister-in-law and I would, and in the summer for a couple of weeks, just leave. We would take all, there between us, there's seven kids at the time, and we would just leave for a couple of weeks and go to California to their grandmother's house, to Andrew and Seth's grandmother's house, and just go play, because it was more helpful to take the kids away than have them home, because what little boy doesn't want to go sit on a tractor with his dad, you know, for all day, he says, but then after 5 minutes, he's bored, you know?
Right, yeah.
Kind of thing. And so, but as the kids grew older, they became really helpful and really necessary. And then also just Andrew's parents and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, Seth and Susie, who we ranch with now. And then even my Uncle Dan, who lives next door to me, was baling hay for a long time. You know, he's going to be 84 this year, so he's not on a tractor anymore. But even he was out there in the summers baling hay when our kids were little. And
was that just to help out? Because you didn't come from your upbringing anyway, right, where you were doing this work.
No. He and my dad lived on a ranch for 2 years when they were little boys, and it's the thing they talk about every day still. And so he said, hey, Andrew, he knew, you know, when you have a huge storm coming and your hay is ready and the field is full and you've got three balers but only two guys to run them. And he's like, hey, I can remember how to drive a tractor. Just show me. And it's like Uncle Dan was a stellar baler for years. So it was fun. He just jumped right in, and because he's retired. And so he's watching these tractors and he's like, I can do that.
I feel like what your kids grew up with, there's this image of sort of an idyllic childhood, and yes, maybe even family life as well. Mm-hmm. And if we take that a step further, the community. Yeah. You know, I mentioned the multiple generations. Mm-hmm. You have neighboring ranches. Mm-hmm. You're part of something much larger that is the ranching community and the neighborly friendliness, where you will make meals for each other when it's needed, mm-hmm, and you're there in mutual support and all of these things. It really sounds like such a rich life that, yeah, goes well beyond your own, you know, house walls and your, yeah, own immediate family.
Yeah.
And it kind of had me feeling like there's a sense of belonging that is not part of my life.
Hmm.
Now, admittedly, I don't participate in some of the same things that you do. I'm, yeah, not engaged in faith in the way that I know is important to you. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, I'm not in that 1% that grew up with ranching,
mm-hmm,
and what that meant to family, and, yeah, how you have to be there for each other to share in that work. Yeah. So I'm part of the large, I think, majority of Americans that are disconnected even from within our own families, let alone our neighbors.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, I don't even know their last names.
Yeah.
For those I do know a first name, I don't know my neighbor's last names, and we don't know what they do, what each other does.
Yeah.
So yeah, your life in that way feels kind of idyllic.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I'll say old fashioned for lack of a better word coming, mm-hmm, to mind, but meaning in a positive sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Where your neighbors, you need your neighbors. Yeah.
Tell me about that. Tell, yeah, me what that sense of belonging and how much that, you know, is significant in your life and your family's life.
Yeah. Well, we have, I'm thinking of two specific neighbors. Well, in our family, our neighbors, right? It's 'cause we all live pretty near each other. But and we do have one of my son's best friends from growing up is now working for us full time. And so he's one of our neighbors, Wyatt. And we couldn't do it without Wyatt now these days. We're getting older and our kids are in college or beyond. And so I would say he's a neighbor we can't live without for sure on the ranch. But we have another couple neighbors, Jim and Gina Clark, who they have some cows and they raise some hay. But we ride with them all summer. They come along and they help because it's fun. You want to get on your horses. Your horses need to be ridden. It's fun to go ride the forest in the summer and move cows. But then, you know, our tractor breaks down right in the middle of the harvest. It's like, oh, here, I'll come help you. Or Andrew breaks his leg. I'll never forget Jim bringing out a chaise lounge kind of thing out to our barn. And he's like, Andrew, you sit in that chair and don't you get up, because Andrew's leg is broken and Jim's in there fixing his tractor for him. And he's like, if you get up, I'm going home, you know, kind of thing. And so it's just this, you feel like people have your back, and hopefully they feel that same way about you. So just one of our friends, Danae, just this last week, she was working cattle and one of her bulls kicked her and broke both of her bones in her lower leg. And so to have, I'd say Danae is like very integral to their operations on the daily basis, much more so than I am. And to have her down with a broken leg is just terrible. So, you know, we talked last night with her husband. It's like, well, that's on my list this week, is to bring her dinner. You know, it's something I can do because we've been there and it's so frustrating just to be laid up. So.
It sounds incredibly painful to take a kick like that from a bull.
Right?
That's, yeah, another story that you describe is when the bulls did not get fed one night and at midnight, You were the one who went out to feed them because Andrew was sick and trying to get some sleep. And how scary that was in the night with these big, powerful bulls and the risks of doing that. So to take a kick like that that would break both of the lower bones there, I can't imagine the amount of pain. And this is a daily risk, right? In terms of ranching, is that there's always something, whether it's with the mechanics, you know, tractors, if it's with, you know, the livestock themselves, or, I mean, I don't know, even encountering a rattlesnake out on the field, right?
For sure. Every day, well, whenever we go ride in the summer, just getting on these horses just feels very vulnerable because they're big and fast and often unpredictable. And so when you come home at the end of the day and nobody got hurt, it's pretty exciting. You know, just you're a little amped up in the morning because you never quite know what's going to happen because the cows are unpredictable, the horses are, and the weather is. And, you know, when you're riding and then all of a sudden this huge rainstorm hits and lightning and thunder, everything's cracking around you. It's like, it's just, it's a kind of a crazy situation. So
in a movie, if I'm just home on my couch watching it, that all sounds really awesome and sexy to see. It's like, wow, there's this iconic thing, right, of a cowboy out on the range, and they're dealing with these things. But to actually be out there and have to live these things is far more challenging in reality, I'm sure.
Because and we've had those days where we do come home with a broken back or a broken leg, or our neighbor, the neighbor I was telling you about, Jim, I mean, one day he broke his leg. He got thrown and we were out at the pasture and it was like, okay, we, for the first time, used the SOS function on our phone. I've never used it before, but it worked. It was fantastic. But, you know, so there, to have the days, it just, that's what makes the good days really good, is when you've had the bad days and you know that, like, wow, this was a day of sunshine and no injuries and we found the cows and it was a good day.
You broke your back at some point, right? Was that related to work on the ranch or was that something completely different?
I was getting on my horse. We were getting ready to go put one of our dogs, had just a stomach full of cancer and tumors. And so we were getting ready to go put him down. So my husband had his gun in one pocket and a steak and a Ziploc bag in the other one. And we were going to take him for a last ride. His favorite thing was to go running along with us with our horses. And so, but it happened to be a really stormy day and we were just going to go take him up by our pond and put him down. But it's like the storm came in and then we had a certain family member living with us who was kind of working with training a horse and it was pretty skittish. And anyway, like lightning hit and it flew up and reared up. And then my horse took off while I was getting on him. And it was my mistake. My mind was, you know, with like sad, we were putting our dog down.
Well, and sure. So, what you're describing there, again, you're not going to a vet. My experience with that is we need a veterinarian to administer the shot that does that when it's finally time. And I imagine a lot of difficulty with that. You know, it is, I assume, you know, Andrew still feels that in his heart and he's sad. And that's a matter of, it's a task that might be mercy. And is necessary. And yet, again, for a non-ranching person like myself, that's a foreign idea where I'm just like, oh, I don't know that I could do that, right? I'm trying to look at where, while owning my own, I guess, who I am. I mean, I don't feel like I need to apologize for not being someone who has the skills and knowledge that you all do in that life. But it can feel like in our society, there's a gap of understanding between people who live in, say, cities. Or just me, even in a small town growing up, and those who are actually out engaged in these things. And it's very difficult to understand what some of those details in your life are. And that it's not done, you know, without compassion and the heart sometimes getting in, involved too. And man, that's tough.
It is tough. It is hard to have legislation happen by people who maybe don't understand the day to day. We used to be pretty involved with Farm Bureau, and we got to go to Washington, D.C. one time, the two of us, to talk to some senators about a bill that was being introduced about children in agriculture, which the heart behind it was awesome because it was a lot about like migratory workers, you know, coming in for this harvest and that harvest, and but their kids were coming with them and they weren't ever in school. And so they were constantly moving around, which totally makes sense in that scenario. But it was basically meaning that our kids couldn't mow our lawn, they couldn't help with branding, they couldn't be on a horse and move cows, they couldn't, the details were so crazy when applied to our situation. And so we went and we're just like, our kids are home baling hay for us right now while we're out here to talk to you, and that would be illegal under this. And so they were like, oh yeah, we got to make some changes to this, because the intent of it was great with a great heart and stuff. But when you apply it to a different situation, it was just completely absurd.
So. This reminds me of another story that you shared. And this was with calves who were born at the time of year where it still is cold, it's wet, mm-hmm. we're transitioning into spring, but it's not quite maybe the best conditions for that. And then you have a calf come out that is overexposed, potentially at risk of hypothermia, and you could lose them. So what you do is take them into your family's bathtubs. to put them in warm water and try to, you know, massage them and revive them as needed. And that was a reason accepted at the school, right? Just a regular understanding that ranch kids have work to do, and this is a dire moment where there's livelihood and the lives of these calves at stake. And you just call and say, this, you know, it's a calving day and we've got a problem.
We'll bring him in when we can. They're like, oh, that's fine.
That's understood. It's just amazing to me. Well, I mean, first of all, let's go back to this story. Because again, it's in your bathtub. We're talking about a calf. I mean, you got mud, blood, afterbirth, manure.
Yes.
And of course, I'm picturing all this and thinking that is a different, like, I'm not real crazy about my wife washing our dog in the bathtub. Just, you know, that's enough. If I'm really honest about it.
But it feels like the right thing to do in the moment. You know, you come in, you're like, this calf's going to die if we don't help it. So the idea of your clean bathtub just goes out the window. You know, it's just like the hierarchy of priorities changes pretty significantly.
And then you're able to clean that well enough that you're at least psychologically able to think the next time you take a bath.
This
is clean.
Didn't know that that's what my day was going to entail. You know, that's, I think, a lot of it. There has to be a lot of flexibility in agriculture, because you can have your plans for the day, but they more often than not are way different than.
You mentioned a list earlier. You live by lists. Yeah. You refer to those often in your writing, and that every day, of course, has a list and probably a range of, you know, the tasky, detailed, mundane sort of stuff all the way up to the bigger things. And probably every day that can get thrown out of whack.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, emergency can throw it out of whack, or just, you know, something, the cows get out. I mean, that you just drop everything. Doesn't matter what you're doing when you have cows out. Our cattle now, in the summer, we have this awesome Forest Service permit up near Buffalo Peaks. And so when the sheriff calls you and says your cows are out on 285, I mean, doesn't matter what you're doing. You have to get up there and put them back in, because people are driving 70 miles an hour. And if they, you know, those are people's lives at stake. So not to mention the cows.
Do you take your cattle over to 4 Mile?
So we're on the opposite side of Buffalo Peaks. So, so it's a like almost 50,000 acre permit allotment that we have with the Forest Service. And so we can graze all summer there. But yeah, so it's just up and over Buffalo Peaks from 4 Mile.
I sometimes encounter people's cattle when I'm out there in the summer, you know. And to me, that's just interesting that we're sharing this land like that. I'm out there for a trail run, or I'm on a bike or something. Or, you know, of course, people camp out there and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. I love seeing the cattle, I guess. And in part because it does call back to my childhood. And it's sort of a story, I think, of what I didn't experience and did I miss out. Because all my friends around me, again, they're going deer hunting, and the teachers are writing on the chalkboard throughout deer hunting season who got the biggest rack, you know, on a buck, and things like that that I couldn't participate in because that wasn't my life. So I think there's always, even all these years later, there's a real fascination to me about understanding the work that you do. And kind of maybe wishing that I had some knowledge of it, that I had been like your uncle and dad, having at least a couple of years when I was a kid to call back to that experience. And I just don't have that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's pretty awesome that we live in a place where you can still get out, though. You know, like you're saying, you're out trail running, and I think we can create experiences for our kids. They don't necessarily have to be on the farm, but, you know, the Hutchinson Ranch has a summer program, a farmhands program where kids can go and they can learn how to irrigate and learn more about agriculture, which is great. So there's opportunities, but it is different than just living in it. Naomi, my second daughter, she called the other day and she said, "Mom, I'm reading this book, The Anxious Generation." Did you ever read that?
Yeah, by Jonathan Haidt.
And she was like, "I was just calling to thank you for our childhood." She's like, "I know it wasn't perfect, but," she's like, "thank you for the days in the fields just picking dandelions with Ellie, you know, and just this openness and this outside." It was always just outside. It's just being really important for kids, especially now with phones and...
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. In reading so much of your book, I was thinking about the memories that they're carrying going forward.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, I realize there's a shaping of the story through what was shared in the book. Mm-hmm. And I would be curious to know, you know, about some of the lesser moments maybe too.
Yeah.
But I do think that their childhood memories have to be overflowing.
Yeah.
And that they will be grateful for having learned how to do hard things.
Yeah.
And having been part of hard work and learned how to, I mean, the driving tractors and trucks and whatever, probably at a young age, and horses and the cattle and just all of the things that, again, I mean, I'm going to be the example for an awful lot of people. Yeah. Just wasn't part of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm grateful that I think it's we are part of a generation that was raised. You've described yourself as a latchkey kid of the 80s, and that sounds very familiar for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that I am part of a generation that still pre-phone, pre-internet, had a lot of time outside, learned how to do a lot of things on our own, learned how to be really responsible or independent or, you know, take consequences for what we got into.
Mm-hmm.
And your kids have such an abundance of that.
Yeah, it does. It feels like a really special time they're growing up. And the ranch feels really different with them gone. Esther's at home still. But everybody else is in college and off in careers. And so it feels really different at home now because they're not all working. And, you know, there are those moments where, you know, Andrew's like, "All right, we're going to Murdoch's and everybody's getting a pair of Wranglers." And they're all just like, "Dad, we don't wear Wranglers. Like, we wear skinny jeans." And he goes, "The minute you start fixing fence and those skinny jeans, you call them," he's like, "you might as well be wearing tights." He's like, "barbed wire is going to hit those." And there's this conflict at the table. You know, it's like, "you have to wear long sleeve shirts." And, "I don't want to wear a long sleeve shirt." He's like, "well, you're wearing a long sleeve shirt." You know, so there's definitely those moments of growing up where they're just like, "are you kidding me? And we have to be down at 7 on a Saturday morning? Like, Dad, you got to be joking me." Or, you know, so there's definitely the harder, you know, parts of parenting with that.
That makes me feel a little better, actually, because I kind of was feeling like you must have the best family on earth, because it seemed like all the kids were so, you know, into the work together, that their relationships were so great together and with all of you together.
Yeah.
And I guess I kind of thought, man, my teenagers aren't really, you know, cooperative like that.
Yeah. I do have the best family on earth. I do have to say they are amazing, but none of us are perfect. No, I mean, our girls fought over clothes. Our boys got in wrestling fights on the floor. I mean, no, we're just all people, right?
Sure.
You know, and but it's just a special time. But the one thing I do want to encourage people is just everybody's got to eat each day, you know, and you get to hopefully at some point in some meal pick who you're going to eat with and what you're going to talk about and what you're going to eat. And so it doesn't matter what country you live in or where you live in or what your house is like, or, you know, if you have a card table for a table or no table or a big table like ours or whatever. It's like that's the important part, is sitting with your family, you know, and you know, learning things together, doing dangerous things, having adventures. You know, I think those are all important, but it might not be ranching, but it's being together and doing things together. I think that's the important thing.
Your memoir is called The Table, of course. Mm-hmm. So it's centered around this physical, actual table that you and Andrew built. Mm-hmm. And it's sizable, and it can accommodate, you know, a large family beyond even the number of kids and things that you have. Again, we have extended family of multiple mm-hmm. generations.
Yeah.
And if we go back to that, I want to come back to this mentorship aspect yeah. and the closeness that you had with your in-laws,
yes.
your mother-in-law, your mm-hmm. father-in-law. That mm-hmm. sounds like it was so full of love.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, it's a tremendous loss in your family when each of them yeah. in time would pass on,
yes.
both from cancer, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Will you tell me something about that relationship and how you came into this, at the time, new life of ranching, mm-hmm. this new family with mm-hmm. all these roots in ranching,
yeah,
and how yeah. you were able to not only learn about all of that, but figure out how to blend in with that family and develop so much love and mm-hmm. and openness to what they had to teach you?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was amazing. You know, in the book, I described that we got to live with them for a year and a half when we moved to Salida. You know, Andrew's dad had retired and bought the beginnings of the ranch down here long ago, back when the prices were normal. And to be able to live with them and to see what it was like to live with a mom and a dad that are married and have been married for a long time. I remember, you know, years of that. Up until I was about six. So I have memories of that with my own parents, but then, you know, they were divorced. And so then it was a much different upbringing from there. And so to watch like older adults in a marriage was pretty fantastic. And that wasn't perfect either. I mean, we all laughed the other day. We were going through some of Andrew's dad's things in the kitchen and the pressure cooker was in there, you know, where you can like put potatoes in, and it's kind of an older, you know, whatever. Some people like them.
Like
some
for canning vegetables from the garden or something.
Yeah, but they would always put potatoes or something in there. But they always fought about this pressure cooker. And it was like a metaphor for their relationship. Like, it's going to blow in a minute, right? And so it's like, hey, does anybody want their pressure cooker? And it's like, we're all like, no, nobody wants their pressure cooker, because it's like the memories from that were like not always, you know, fun. It was kind of stressful. So, you know, they're just normal people, but to have this home where they welcomed me into their family and just the unique relationship I was able to have with either of them. And Ruthie and I switched off cooking each night, every other night when we moved in. And that was so fun. And it was terrifying, because I was like, I didn't really know how to cook very well. And, you know, she was an amazing cook. And, you know, my father-in-law was pretty, you know, opinionated about things. And I remember one night I was making dinner and the whole entire kitchen was a disaster. I think I'd used every pot in the house. And he's like, you know, Ruth has a really great way of like cleaning up as she goes, or something, or like not using every pot in the kitchen, basically, or whatever. And I was kind of like, oh. It was this a little bit of like, I want to impress my in-laws, you know, that I want to be capable and all this. But oh, I just feel like I made so many mistakes. But looking back now, they became my best friends, you know, so it was definitely a growing relationship. And yeah, to have lost them is a tremendous loss for sure.
You even helped with your father-in-law at the end.
Yes.
In significant ways.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So he lived 10 years. It'll be 11 years this summer that Ruthie passed away. And he lived for 10 years past her. She died of lung cancer. And he changed during those 10 years. He became softer. And we got to know a side of him that I don't think we would have necessarily.
Even Andrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And he just always said yes about anything, adventures, river trips, hikes, anything, trips, just whatever. He was up for it, and came over for dinner a lot to our house, and then also to my brother-in-law Seth and his wife Susie's house. And just, you know, he just was all about family, and it was fun to watch him grow as a person during that time. And so yeah, he, in December of this last year, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And yeah, I was in the emergency room with him when he got the diagnosis, and that was a tough day. And I just remember him looking, and he's like, the hardest thing is that I'm just going to miss you. You know, like this, he just loved his family ferociously. And so I don't think he was too sad necessarily about going, you know, he was 81, lived a really full, great life, but it was just the relationships were going to be the thing. So we moved in with him. My husband and I and our daughter Esther moved in with him for the last 2 months of his life. And so just took care of him through that whole process. And there were some really joyful days and some really hard days, for sure. But it was a really special time.
You had previously described that as an inspiration in watching how he handled this process of dying, essentially, knowing that this is the end.
Yeah.
Can you share more with me on what you saw as inspiration and in maybe what you learned, anything you might have learned about how he handled this, you know, this circumstance and knowing that this family that means so much and the ranch and the everything here, I think it's, you know, certainly not everyone who gets to know that that end is coming.
Right.
And prepare.
Yes. And to have that time to say goodbye. And boy, he was just a trooper. I think the one thing that hit me was that, you know, you spend a whole lifetime acquiring and working and saving and, you know, just, and then to watch somebody die and that you take nothing with you. You know, that you leave everything here, all of the material possessions, the land, the everything. You don't take it with you. And so I feel like so much of our focus in life is on all this stuff and all of the experiences and things. And then to just, we leave the way we came, you know, and it feels very spiritual and intentional. You know, you almost, it is like a full circle to watch, you know, a birth and then to watch a death. And they feel very, very similar, I would say. And he was fascinated with the process of dying, just the actual physiological, like, wow, so this is happening in my body. You know, one of his legs, he had tons of fluid in his legs, and just to have one of them be heavier and more filled with fluid, and the hospice nurse said, oh, that's because the opposite side of your heart is failing. So it's always the opposite. And so it's not moving the heart fluid through your body. And I'm like, what the heck is heart fluid? Like, it was just, it was fun to, even though it was this terribly sad time, he was a learner till the very last, you know. It's just, he was like, oh, that's really interesting, isn't it? And I think he just wanted to know how it was going to work. And just a great shout out to the hospice nurses in Salida. I mean, they're just fantastic, and we're straight shooters and compassionate and kind, and I couldn't have done it without them.
That's an incredible way to handle, you know, what otherwise would be just bad news.
Yeah.
And whatever you're observing about your body every day is, oh, hey, here's something else that is different, doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
Things are getting worse. To actually approach it with such a curiosity and fascination to say, I want to learn about this thing.
Yeah.
And carry that all the way to the last is, yeah, that is inspiring.
Yeah.
That is impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just makes you, to watch somebody's body slowly stop functioning, makes you really thankful for your body that's functioning. I mean, I know, you know, we all have stuff that's like not working right or whatever, and people are in different stages of dying, and I don't want to discount that. But I mean, just there's so many systems happening in our bodies right now as you and I are talking, and it's just miraculous. And then to watch those systems start to shut down is, I think we really take for granted our days, for sure.
You also got to gather your family and kind of have a memorial or a funeral or something for him while he was still present for it, right?
Yeah.
So basically getting a chance to share with him what he meant to each of you and to all of you.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really special Christmas Day. It was our last Christmas with him. Just this morning, we have a journal for our family that's our Christmas journal, and we write every year in it what we did for Christmas, and I hadn't done it yet. And so I was killing time before seeing you today, and I was just writing in that. It was just, it was a special time, you know. So my husband was like, all right, guys, we're going to, you know, you don't want to buy Papa anything. Like, doesn't make sense, right? You know?
Yeah.
We all stress out about Christmas gifts and, you know, all this stuff, and it's like, it was just a real, like, wow, what really means something to someone? And so he's like, you know, maybe write a verse, you know, a poem or a Bible verse or a story or whatever, just if you want to say something to him. And so that was a super special time. Yeah.
If we talk more about the ranch and ranching, you know, it strikes me as simultaneously this, I mean, human history long skill set and knowledge and way of being, and simultaneously it is something that you have to be innovative and constantly learning, and best methods change. And you mentioned before, you know, weather patterns and different things affect what's happening, and climate change, and we've got wildfire risk and drought and all the things that can change up everything you think you know about it. Mm-hmm. And right now, today, or this season, we have to figure out a different answer, right? Yeah. So it's this constantly living experience, mm-hmm. while also being rooted in something that's so fundamental to humans throughout history.
Yes.
And that's amazing to me. I would like to talk about the things that you see as especially important right now, mm-hmm. in your experience as a rancher. Mm-hmm. I know that land development is an issue.
Yes.
And please share whatever you want about that, or yeah. anything else that you see as, you know, what's on your mind, what's mm-hmm. what's maybe a threat to this way of life, yeah. as the 1%, mm-hmm. you know, went from 90% down to 1%, you know,
yeah.
that's,
yeah.
that's a trajectory of where we're losing this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I mean, ranching on its own, just without the outside influences, is a pretty challenging lifestyle, farming and ranching. And then to have kind of the outside influences, oh, just for example, if we're moving cattle from one field to another and we have to go down a couple of county roads, you know, and you have a couple hundred head of cattle in the middle of the road, and people get mad, you know, and they're honking their horns, or they drive right through fast, and, you know, just stuff like that, where it's just like, if people could just like slow down and take a deep breath and, you know, just not be mad about something like that. But it's hard because we live in a fast world. You know, we don't have a lot of margin in our lives, and we do too. I mean, it's the same thing. It's like you talk about the list. It's like, oh, we got to do this and this and this, or, you know, we're racing up to South Park if our cows are out. So, you know, we can be in a hurry too. So it's not that we're isolated from that, but just maybe trying to work a little bit more with people in ag would be super helpful. And, you know, just there's a lot of, you know, opinions and stuff about the, you know, the wolves being introduced into Colorado. And there's so many different, you know, takes on that. Like, is this even good for the wolves themselves that have been reintroduced? And, you know, obviously the ranchers and, you know, that whole conversation. But just the other day, we had Andrew's dad's dog, you know, when he passed away. And so we inherited his dog, his best friend. And we were outside working on corrals and all this. And all of a sudden we hear this calf in our back corral who is lame back there because he had a hurt leg. And we hear it just screaming. And it's a very distinct sound to have a calf. It's not just a normal bawling of a calf. It's like this desperate plea, you know, and there's like, what is that? We go over there and his dad's dog is chewing on this calf and just tearing into it. And he, you know, he running over there and, you know, yelling at him, trying to pull him up, you know, kicking him as hard as he can in the ribs, like five times, like would have broken a rib, you know, just Meander's just like, get off that. And the mom comes over and she starts like hitting him, the dog, and he won't let go. He's got his teeth on this calf and he will not let go. And then there's like about six other moms come and they finally did this like awesome herd mentality that I've never seen before. I've seen one cow be very protective, but to see like a group of moms come over and just lay into him, and they basically threw him, you know, but it's tough. And I mean, Andrew put him down, you know, immediately. He's like, I can't have an animal like that around your cattle. Like, it's just you. And obviously we have kids and, you know, other animals and stuff, but it's not just like the wolves. It's just, you're protecting your animals, you know? And so even if it's a dog, but that's tough, you know, to have his dad die,
sure.
and then have to go bury his dog.
Yeah. That's yeah.
kind of tough, but.
And I want to get into the land development piece a bit, I guess, because as I think about this, so much has changed. You mentioned when Andrew's parents started buying some ranch land.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so prices were, I think, I don't remember how you said it, but basically they were much more rational.
Yes.
Than where yeah. we've come to be, mm-hmm. with, you know, the housing market and land. How is this impacting your work, aside from the fact that, again, if we look at the disconnect, the gap between people who understand what your life is out here and what it means to the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they're out there riding bikes on the roads that go by your ranch, or they're driving too fast, or they're impatient because you're moving a herd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that all rolls into one. That what we're talking about is there's been a big shift in population,
mm-hmm.
in the past few decades, and there's been a big shift in what it means to have a ranch,
yeah.
and be able to protect its future,
mm-hmm.
against things like land development and, I mean, all the reasons people want to get a hold of your land.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we were just on a walk the other day, and Andrew's always got a shovel when we're walking, and he was kind of irrigating along the way, and I'm just like, the soil is amazing. You just you see a shovel full of it, and it's just dark and beautiful. And he was like, why a community would ever allow land like this, soil like this, to be developed? You know, it's because we get our food from other places. But he's like, the moment that our community didn't have access to food outside of it, we would be like, wow. You know, because there's not all the land in Chaffee County is this beautiful soil that can be used to grow things. You know, it's very rocky. It's very, you know, river rock everywhere. And so, we're looking at this soil, and then you can hear in the distance, you know, the machines working, getting ready to put in this big subdivision to the east of us. And they're, you know, putting in close to 70 houses over there. And you do the math, and, you know, you add those lots up, and it's like over $17 million for that land, you know. And then you're irrigating and having cattle and stuff. And it's like, it's a very glaring reality, you know, to like, wow, there is this value, but then to realize that there is this value of like the things that you're talking about, you know, heritage and family and land. And yet we have this new generation, right? And currently none of them are ranching right now, you know, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens. We love it, and they loved growing up here. And so I don't know, we'll see what happens. You know, the county, I feel like, has taken steps to kind of move away from the high density subdivisions on agricultural land, just with the new zoning and things like that. So I don't know. It is my hope. I would love for the land to remain as it is, and yet still have our kids be able to come back and build a house if they want, and that kind of thing. So I don't know.
Do you feel like that you are kind of in a position that you might not even want to have to be advocates basically to protect that land beyond your family's own future? Mm-hmm. Like, you're part of a smaller population. Yeah. And it gets smaller and smaller as families end up selling the land for one reason or another. Maybe they don't have another generation to take it over.
Right.
Or those dollar signs can be really attractive, right? Mm-hmm. You're sitting on millions of dollars of land, but you're not millions of dollars rich in your pocket.
No. And it involves a lot of people. It's not just me. You know, it's a big family, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the future. Yeah. You don't know when one of your kids, they all have these roots, might want to come back and continue this. Mm-hmm. But does that make you sort of feel like you have to almost be this warrior on behalf of the land and agriculture and sustaining a way of life that there's so much kind of encroachment on because of things like, let's develop a neighborhood here instead?
Yeah. You know, I don't feel like that. I feel like we still have, you know, rights as property owners, you know, and it's kind of what we're going to choose to do with it. I'm more excited just to see what the kids can come up with, you know, and the cousins and all that. And it is exciting to think about them being able to go and do other things too, that they don't have to ranch. And so I guess I feel maybe a little bit more hands off and just hoping that they're inspired to something great other than maybe just selling out, but maybe being creative and thinking about things and how to preserve this heritage, but also to gain something. I don't know. It'll be interesting.
A way to preserve the land, even if they choose not to continue with ranching.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's different ways to do things, you know, maybe. And there are a lot of new kind of conservation ideas about helping ranches still continue on and yet people getting some value from that. And it seems like there's a lot of people trying to think through instead of just so quickly being like, wow, this is worth a lot. We're just going to sell it and move, you know.
Are you talking about something like conservation easements?
Yeah. Yeah. But even more so, there are conservation easements with like a working side to them, like you're talking about, where younger people who want to be in ag but don't come from an ag family. And because you can't just come buy land in Chaffee County and be like, I'm going to be a farmer and make it. I mean, you just, that's just not going to happen, you know, just because of the price of the land. And so sometimes pairing that with a conservation easement and then people being paid, you know, different things. I don't know all the ins and outs of them, but I know that there are a lot of people trying to work on different things. So
with those easements, you wrote that the average cost for that is around $70,000. Mm-hmm. And I know nothing about how they work, but that sounds like such a significant investment, and it might not even end up coming through.
Right.
A rancher could put $70,000, give or take, into this process and then have whoever all is involved with the government and whatever that that give and take is might decide, no, this isn't the way we're going to go forward here. So that, that seems like an iffy proposition at best. And I don't know, is that worth spelling out maybe what an easement is meant to be when it does work?
Yeah, I do think there is more funding available now than there used to be to help agricultural families with those easements to where they can basically still own their land, but in a way sort of sell the developmental rights to a conservation program. And so you get paid good money to just not ever develop your land. You can still work it, you still own it, but it does help families where maybe you have some siblings or something who live in another state and aren't interested at all in ranching, but they're like, hey, like this land is worth this much, you know, what you got, we need to sell the ranch. And then you've got the people working it being like, oh my gosh, like that's our livelihood and we live here and we love this and we don't want to sell it. And so a conservation easement is a great tool for families to use where it gives some cash to the family and, you know.
So those siblings who are detached from it might feel like they're getting something out of the having the land. It kind of maybe staves off the idea of let's cash out.
Or a lot of ranches are doing, you know, wedding venues and stuff. So maybe a conservation easement helps build like some great infrastructure for something like that. Or, you know, thinking a little bit more outside the box of like, how can we use that money to make money, you know, that kind of thing too. So I think people are hopefully going to be getting creative.
Does it feel strange to you at all that you have this memoir out in this small community? And so now for anybody who has picked this up and read it, and for those who will, there's an awful lot for them to know about not only your family, but I would say even, you know, as someone myself who is a writer and who expresses publicly in various ways, including this podcast, there's vulnerability in that. And you have let people into sort of your interior world of how you think about things, how you feel about things. Do you feel at all sort of vulnerable that in this small community, your neighbors, your friends, the people who know you are like, wow, this is her story. This is much more than we even knew.
Yeah, definitely. It is. It's a vulnerable feeling for sure. That, well, there's been a couple of book clubs that have read it and they're like, hey, can you come, you know, we're gonna have dinner and talk about your book. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that sounds fun / terrifying, you know. And you walk into a room and these women look at you with these sweet faces and they're like, we feel like we know you so well after reading your book. And I was like, and it's just weird to be like, I don't know any of your names, you know. But I think if it would inspire people to be more vulnerable with each other and maybe a little bit more honest and share stories, and that would be great.
Before we're done, I want you to read a section that you write in the book related to the value of us sharing stories. And I think that is so relevant to We Are Chafee as a community storytelling initiative. So we're going to come to that. I just want to say that while I'm thinking of it so we don't forget.
Okay.
I feel like the memoir overall is just such, you know, a wonderful distillation of the value of ranching, of this life, of being in a rural community, of preserving and protecting things that matter and have value that are beyond those dollars, those millions of dollars in this kind of case, of family. You know, we haven't dived into your faith, but that is clear in what you've written and shared too, and that this is a thread that runs through the family. There's just so much, I think, that is amazing of what you've shared in that. And I mean, I'd be happy for you to share anything else you feel like is important that we haven't touched on here, because there's an awful lot in that book that we, and the rest of life, of course, that we haven't gotten into. I mean, you and your family have lived a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I guess the thing that I hope people would take from it is that at the end of the day, it really is the people in your life who are the most important, you know. And I know we get busy and, you know, even ranching, Andrew and I are trying to figure out how to have some boundaries with the ranch because it's pretty all-encompassing. But I think any job can be that way. I got to teach at the high school for a year, and it's just, it's hard to leave work at work sometimes. Well, especially when you live where you work, but just maybe having some boundaries in life, and whether that's boundaries with, you know, our phones and actually sitting down and looking at somebody face to face and having a conversation. We've been trying to close our evenings with reading out loud as a family. And it's Esther and Andrew and me at home right now. You know, there's eight of us now with my new son-in-law. So that's fun. But when it's just Andrew and Esther and me, just to, at the end of the day, just sit down and take turns reading from a book out loud, like it just sort of slows life down. And it just, those feel like special times just to be together. And I don't know, maybe turn off the TV, put the phones away and do something a little bit more intentional.
I think it's worth noting that while I have highlighted, because I'm acknowledging the fact that I don't know your way of life, right? So there's this gap between that way of being and all the many millions of people I represent who haven't got a clue about how to work a ranch. Mm. We also have a lot in common. And I'm sure mm-hmm. the more we talk, the more we would find. Mm-hmm. But if we look back at you and Andrew were both rafting guides. Mm-hmm. Your family goes to Monarch and skis. Yeah. You Nordic ski. You mm-hmm. run. You bike. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of those sorts of activities that yeah. a lot of us come to this valley for. Mm-hmm. And we have this in common. And I guess that just hit me. I think it's worth noting that we're not only talking about how yeah. we're so different in things. It's actually, yeah. to me, mm-hmm. that we have an awful lot in common.
Yeah.
I just am appreciating getting to learn from you the things that are totally new. And like I said at the very beginning of this, it's so eye-opening to mm-hmm. have you describe so much in the book of what it was that I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we're just average. I mean, we're married, you know, we have good days in our marriage, bad days in our marriage. Same with parenting, you know, where you just throw up your hands and we're like, well, there's another therapy session for our kids when they're older, you know, like we really screwed that one up, or oh, this moment, like just look at this for a minute, you know, everybody's doing this, you know, or the first time we got all of our kids on skis at Monarch for the first time, and we were all going down the slope, and it was just like, this is exciting. I'm not home with somebody while Andrew takes everybody else. And, you know, just those little moments of growth and change, and, or, oh my gosh, you know, we've just, and one of our sons is graduating from CSU this next week, and it's like, wow, another one set sail, you know, I don't know. Those feel like exciting things that are in common. You know, it's not all weird, ranchy things.
Someone had pointed out to me a while back that when we're talking about where we have differences with people, and especially mm-hmm. if we look at what's going on in our world right now, mm-hmm. where it can feel like we are so opposed or divided, mm-hmm. I think it comes from not knowing each other's stories yeah. and recognizing what we do share.
Yeah.
I lost the rest of my thought there, but I do mm-hmm. think it still serves as a segue. I'm going to hand you the couple of paragraphs that I have pulled from your book.
Yeah.
And if you would please share that,
sure.
because again, it's relevant about the value of us sharing stories with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where the idea of the table comes, is because if you can sit around the table, and it's just a place where everybody eats and drinks, and that's what we all have in common, right? We all need those things. And so it levels the playing field, you know? And so then to be able to learn how to listen and ask questions and share stories. And there's been some heated conversations around our table where people have gotten up and are just like, I can't believe you, you know? But in general, I think it's a gift to be able to share a story, and it's a gift to listen to somebody's story.
You reminded me of where I was headed with my train of thought there too. And that is, if we focus on the values that we share, mm-hmm. what are the values we have in common in yeah. family and those mm-hmm. opportunities, like you're describing, sitting around the table together and being with each other. And mm-hmm. we do have so much that connects us.
Yeah.
If we focus on that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right, here we go. My family and I have been sanded, stained, and shined by our stories that come from the different seasons on the ranch and from the different seasons of life. Everyone has a story to tell. Sharing our stories with each other allows us to learn from one another's failures and successes. Aren't we all, right now, on this day, whatever season it may be, living stories that are crafting and refining us into something hopefully more beautiful and useful than we were yesterday? This is the hope, that we are always growing and learning, no matter the season. Our stories, both good and bad, should not be wasted. Instead, as our experiences shape and refine us, we can share them at the different tables where we sit, allowing them to teach and inspire and encourage others to live a more abundant life.
Thanks for reading that.
Sure.
So the book, of course, is called The Table. Mm-hmm. Is that available at the Salida Bookstore?
Yes. So it's at the Salida Books downtown and also at the Once Upon a Trapeze in BV.
Okay.
And then also online with Book Club Salida. You can buy it through them. If you go to bookshop.org, you can pretty much put in any independent small bookstore and then a percentage of the sales go to that. It's on Amazon. It's on, you know.
I can include links for all of this with the mm-hmm. show notes. Okay. So that will help people get there. But of course, if they know the local spots here, I'm glad that it's available there. Mm-hmm. You know what we didn't touch on was that this book came out of you being an MFA student in and nature writing was the focus, right?
Yes.
At Western University in Gunnison?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and that's also who published the book?
Yes.
So this is a local homegrown thing through and through.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. So, Western Press Books is the university's sort of publishing house. It's distributed through the University Press of Colorado. But yeah, so it was an incredible, if anybody's looking to get an MFA doing creative writing, it's a fantastic low residency program that I highly recommend. Amazing professors, and you get to read a lot of really good books, and they have you write a lot.
Do you feel like when you went into that program that your writing was, you know, somewhere around the level of what you have showed in this book? Like, did that grow out of your experience in that MFA program, or did you bring this into it?
No. I feel like I learned so much if I look at things that I wrote early on versus what I know now. And I think a lot of that came from just reading really good books, but also the professors who are also writers, authors themselves, you know, award-winning authors. They go through every page, every word with you, and then you have a writing cohort who does the same. And so everything you write, everybody analyzes and gives you, you know, perspectives like, this is really confusing. And what your tenses completely switched in that. For some reason, the tenses are just really hard for me.
That's a tough part of the experience, isn't it? Is when you hand it over, but we give some authority to those who are professor, mm-hmm, editor, mm-hmm, things like that. And so we feel like, oh, they're qualified to judge me. Yeah. But when you hand it to a peer and then they're tearing it apart.
Yes.
The ego can get a little damaged, mm-hmm, and be, you know, resistant, mm-hmm, to that, right?
Yeah. And yet it's really helpful, but it feels very vulnerable. You get to know the people in your program really well. And then they're also at the same time submitting their writing to you. And so it's a great relationship because you both understand how vulnerable it is. Like, something you write is just, you know, it feels like a very part of your soul out there, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, and, sure, you know, there's still the first round, the first edition of this book came out, and you know, I found all these mistakes in it. And I mean, I read this thing hundreds of times. And many people had the copy editing class at Western. You know, it's just still, you know, there's still mistakes. And, you know, so you kind of go like cringe or, you know, and then they, you know, correct it on the next printing and stuff like that. So it's a really fun process. And I feel super grateful to Western for publishing it. That was a huge honor.
Something I was wondering the whole time with all of this ranching life, I mean, it's kind of 24/7. You're on call anyway, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Long days, especially during particular times of the year. Mm-hmm. How did you fit in an MFA program and writing a book?
Yes. Okay, well, let me just make a disclaimer. First of all, I would say Andrew is on 24/7 and his brother Seth and Wyatt. I mean, they are on, and the 24 is definitely them. I am, you know, I do the bookkeeping. I help with like a lot of the fun things, and I can be a little bit more selective, whereas they are like, they are on. And so I don't want it to come across that I'm, you know, doing that all the time. I do help substantially, but not, I mean, they're the main
I can appreciate and respect that clarification, but so that somebody listening doesn't think it swings too far to the other side, again, if they read your book, they're going to learn that you are very hands-on and involved in a lot of that I hesitate to say real work, but you know, like hands-on the bowls, hands-on every aspect of it, it feels like pretty much.
Yeah.
With that in mind, you still have your lists and you have family and you had a lot going on.
Absolutely.
How did you find time to write?
Everything we do, everybody has to play their part, you know? So definitely not sustainable to do more than that 2 years. I would say it took a lot from our whole entire family. You know, most of our kids were home at that time. And so a lot of it fell on Andrew. And he was amazing. And, you know, it was kind of his idea, too, which is great. You know, we sat one day, we took a little break for a couple days and went to Uray, and we were camping, and we were just laying in the forest, had our Paco pads laid out, and we were both just reading. And we were just talking about how reading is so awesome and how it's so powerful and relaxing and how books can inspire you. And he's like, you really need to write a book. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, right. Like, I don't have time for that. And I don't know how to do that. And he goes, no, he's like, you need to dream. He's like, I'm living my dream. Ranching is a dream. I mean, it's hard and stuff. But he's like, I love what I do every day. I wake up and he's like, I just love this, you know. And he's like, but what, our kids are getting older. What's your dream? And I was like, well, I would like to write a book and I'd love to teach. And anyway, so it's all his fault. But anyway, so he was amazing. I mean, he just picked up, he and the kids picked up a lot of like making dinners and a lot of things, you know, went by the wayside kind of thing. But it definitely up really early and up really late.
Are you saying dark early morning? Because when I think of your life, it surely starts.
Yeah.
It starts early anyway, right? So for you to get up even earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. Just an hour even before just gave me just a little bit of time to write or do something. And, you know, when you have a deadline, when you have assignments, you have to do it. And so I don't know, I guess I haven't written where you just sort of have your time and then when it's done, it's done. It really was helpful to have an assignment and a deadline, and then you just get it done. And I found it was really hard to ever write during the day unless I left the house. I would get, my father-in-law had this house up on Chavano, kind of like a little family cabin thing, and he was like, go up there, get out. And that really helped. So some days, and Andrew would just be like, don't come back until you have that paper done. Like, just stay. Don't, just feel the freedom to just go. And that made it easier for me because then I could really go and just be there and not have the phone ring or the cows get out or, you know, he's like, I'm not going to call you, you know, if the cows get out, like you're on your own. Like, and that was a huge gift.
That sounds amazing too, because as you probably are aware, there are writing retreats and things that people do, and they try to find, you know, such, again, I'm going to use the word idyllic because it sounds so amazing to be in a cabin in the mountains and to just have space and time to write and not be bothered by, you know, the regular details of life.
Yeah.
But there are writers all over the country who are like, wow, that sounds exactly like what I want.
Yep. It was great. I would go, I set my alarm, I'd write for 3 hours and it would fly by. And then I'd go walk for an hour, I'd hike up to the Colorado Trail, come back 3 more hours. And then, because it just goes, and you need a good chunk, you know, to be able to write and to get into the groove, I think, at least I did. You know, the 1 hour in the morning was good because you could plan or get some ideas and stuff, but you really do need a solid chunk of time. So I think you need to have that as a writer. One of my professors was very calculated with her schedule. And she would be like, I wake up and I write during this time and I don't have my phone. Nobody bothers me. And she's like, that's because she's a professor plus an author. And so I was like, how do you do this? You know, this whole professorship is a lot on its own. And she's like, well, that's because I plan time to write. So you make time for the things that you want to do.
Have you continued writing?
Oh, goodness.
Or is this more of an accomplishment that, yes, I did it, thank you.
Yeah.
Now I'm moving back on to life.
I write usually every day in my journal, just about what's going on in life and what's going on in the ranch, and just reminds me of things. I make my list. My husband's next to me journaling, making his list and stuff. So I would like to write again in the future, but I haven't written anything creatively lately. But, you know, it just seems like there's been a lot going on. But I think there's always a lot going on.
It feels like that is life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it's not one thing, it's another. And, yeah. And you know.
Mm-hmm. I would love to write one day, maybe, I don't know, maybe in the Mountain Mail or something like that. But just to help people be a little bit more attached to ag, like maybe write once in a while about, you know, what's going on, what we're doing in that season, you know, or things that are confronting us, or I don't know, that would appeal to me to do something shorter pieces like that.
You could have a series of those that eventually you bind up and you've got another book.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, this is a treasure of a memoir, and I think mm-hmm. a book for all of us locally. But of course, mm-hmm. there's so much, again, that was eye-opening for me that, you know, the 99% that don't live on a farm or a ranch mm-hmm. Can learn from. And so I really think it's a tremendous piece of work that is, I'm so mm-hmm. glad that for you and for your family as well, thanks. To have this time capsule,
mm-hmm.
it's just amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing it, and thank you for coming on here and talking more with me about it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Chafee podcast. You can learn more about this episode and others in the show notes at wearechafeepod.com and on Instagram at wearechafeepod. I invite you to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I also welcome your telling others about the We Are Chafee podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. The We Are Chafee podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health. Thank you to Andrea Carlstrom, Director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment, and to Lisa Martin, Community Advocacy Coordinator for the larger We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer for the We Are Chafee podcast. Till the next episode, as we say at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.